Hello and welcome to our next edition of our speaker series from the Patika Wealth Management Group. This is John Patika Jr. and we're excited to bring you some timely insights into the markets and in the economy from some of the best perspectives in the industry. And as always, I'm with John Patika Sr., our senior member of our team. And our special guest today is Mike Ryan. Mike is a true veteran of UBS. He began his career in financial services industry in 1984 and started off in one of our old predecessor firms, Payne Webber, and has progressed from research analyst. He was the chief fixed income strategist and ultimately held a position as our chief investment officer for Global Wealth Management Americas. And in 2021, he became one of the firm's vice chairmen. We're happy to have him here with us today. So Mike, welcome to the call.
Well, John, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. After listening to that introduction, I kind of feel old now.
Well, I was born in 1986, so I think it does make you old to me.
Well, Mike, I've been listening to you for more than three decades. And back in the old Payne Webber days, I've been reading your research and you've always kept a level head and you've seen a lot of the great turns in the market. And I think it's really timely to have you here and to share some of your insights with our people. But what I'd like to do first is talk a little bit about bonds. And to do that, I need to start with the very basics. Getting phone calls a lot about the deficit of the United States and other places, frankly, Europe and all. And we hear there's $35 trillion deficit. And I don't think people understand what that is. So what is it made of? Treasury bonds, notes, future obligations? I would appreciate you give us a little debt 101 and to start off with that, if you don't mind, Mike.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today and spending some time with us. So, John, let me break that actually into two separate categories. There's gross debt, which is the debt that's issued by the federal government. This is, you know, to finance our fiscal shortfalls every year. We run a deficit. We have to finance that through debt, right? So we accumulate debt. The number you cited is the gross debt. It's accumulated debt. There's a subset of that debt, though, that's really the focus of markets, and that is the marketable debt held by the public. In other words, some of our debt is actually internally held by Social Security and others. So in other words, it's money the government owes to itself, right? So we have to kind of net that out. And what you really focus on then is the debt that's owned by investors. It's owned by individuals. It's owned by institutions. It's owned by central banks, right? That's kind of the area that a lot of people focus on. Now, that's about $29 trillion. So it's a very large accumulated pool of debt. But that, when we talk about the debt that needs to be financed externally, that's what we're talking about there. That includes treasury bills, treasury notes, and treasury bonds.
So who owns all this?
I kind of gave you a short list, but I would say it's owned by three primary sources. One is it's owned by individuals. So individuals can buy treasury securities. They can certainly buy things like, you know, they can buy bills and notes and bonds. They can also buy savings bonds. That's a form of a debt obligation by the federal government, right? So individuals are a large holder of our treasury debt. A second is institutions. Now, I don't necessarily mean institutions, meaning, you know, like a Bristol Myers or some other company, right? They may hold some, but it's largely held by fund companies. Right. So there's banks and fund companies and insurance companies, pensions. They'll be the largest institutional holders of our treasury debt. And they do so largely on behalf of either the institutions they back. For example, if it's a pension, it's on behalf of the beneficiaries of the pension. If it's an insurance company, it's for the benefit of the policyholders. If it is a mutual fund, it's for the mutual fund holders themselves. And for a bank, it's held as an asset against which the liabilities, that is the bank loans that are put out there, are backed, right? So again, there's different institutional owners of our debt. And then the last is international side, and that is two places. One is there are private individuals, institutions globally that own our debt. They own it for whole lots of reasons. And then there's the central banks or the sovereigns. It can be, again, is a central bank from a government. It can be a sovereign wealth fund. And they hold it largely, central banks, as reserve asset. That is, they use it to back currencies. It's a form of collateral of the obligations that they back. So those are the three principal holders. Again, individuals, institutions on behalf of beneficiaries and foreign governments that largely hold it as reserves for the central bank.
So I don't want to get too deep into tariffs because we're going to talk about that a little later. But so you hear China and Japan and all these countries owning it, and they have we have a trade deficit, so they use that to buy treasuries. Can that really impact us if they don't have so much money to buy our treasuries? Is that a big impact if some of that dries up?
Well, I think there's two concerns that we're hearing right now. One is what you just talked about. Look, when we have a large trade imbalance, right, it means then that we're buying goods from other countries. Let's use China as an example. So we buy their goods, right? So what we exchange for them is we buy their goods and we give them dollars, right? So they have dollars. Now, China sits there and says, okay, we have to do something with these dollars. Now, by and large, what they do with those dollars is they recycle that into treasury securities. So they are large holders, not the largest, but they are large holders of our treasury debt as well. Now, one of the concerns, of course, is that if we have smaller deficits, which is viewed as a good thing overall, there's another side to that. It means then that foreigners may hold less of our debt simply because they don't have to recycle as many dollars into treasuries. So that's one dimension that I think people have focused on is, as we focus on the terms of trade, as we reduce those trade imbalances, how are we going to fund our debt? Because our borrowing needs are not shrinking, they're continuing to rise, right? So that's one concern there. I think the other concern, John, is that, is there a view that people lose faith in the credit quality of the U.S. government, our willingness and ability to fulfill our debt obligation? And therefore, do they actually start to boycott or even sell our treasury securities, which is more of an active act where you're basically proactively going out and saying, okay, I no longer want to be as exposed to the dollar, right? So I think that's probably one of the things that's been a concern of late, is the combination of fewer future purchases of treasury securities through our auctions and on the secondary market because we have that trade imbalance begins to fall. And then secondly, as global investors view the U.S. as less reliable as a store of wealth, as a safe asset that they could actually sell on nothing.
Just maybe a paragraph on U.S. as a reserve currency. You hear a lot of out of breath reporters talking about that. I mean, I guess that they have no choice even right now because they have so much of the dollar out there. But can you see any change to our reserve currency status?
I never say never. There's a whole host of things that can happen, right? I do think that the U.S. has endured as a reserve currency. And by the way, discussions of the reserve status of the dollar is not something new. I go back to the 1980s and I recall, concerns at that time about the U.S. debt and concerns that the world or the global central banks may lose faith in the dollar and therefore less confidence in the treasury securities. And the talk then was perhaps the yen will displace the dollar as a primary reserve currency. And then I've heard it again in the 90s and early 2000s. And at that time, it was going to be the euro that was going to displace the dollar. And then earlier, as we entered this century, the discussion was more around, okay, could China actually emerge and could the renminbi become a reserve currency to displace the dollar? And then more recently, even speculation about, well, could Bitcoin or cryptocurrency or even gold displace the dollar as a reserve asset? And the answer is it's not so easy to displace a reserve currency. Why? Is because there's certain things that a reserve currency requires. You have to have depth and breadth of markets. They have to have lots of liquidity. They have lots of availability. But more than that, they also have to be viewed as being stable safe havens where there's an honoring of property rights and rule of law. Right? So those things are not easy to replicate. Few currencies around the world can replicate parts of that, but there's none that can mimic all of the attributes that really hold the dollar out as a reserve currency. So at this point, I don't see anything supplanting the dollar, certainly not in the near term. However, we can't just take this for granted. Over time, competitors to the dollar may emerge. Let's call it a multi-currency block of different foreign exchange that begins to creep in and ultimately replace the dollar. So I do think there is a risk of that. What you are seeing right now is what I call active de-dollarization. Now, it began largely by some of our potential adversaries. Think about places like Iran and Russia that are subject to sanctions, throw in Korea. But even China more recently has said, well, you know, do we want to have this much exposure to dollars, right? So they're more actively looking at ways they diversify and how they move and become less dependent and therefore less vulnerable to the dollar. So I do think there is, of course, always a risk. I don't think it's a short-term risk, John, but I think over time, if we continue to fail to address our fiscal imbalances, if we continue to run these high chronic budget deficits, and you start to see our credit rating further called into question, then I think, yes, I think what we could see at some point is countries will opt for other options as reserve currency.
Look, we'll go right to that budget deficit comment. Is there a point of no return? I mean, I've heard this explained many ways as if they could get the current budget in line 25 or 30 years from now. The $30 trillion that's out there would be pocket change due to inflation. What do you think about all this? Is there, I know we have a problem and they're not really addressing it. How do you see that playing out?
Let me step away from the debt, the accumulated debt, because I don't know that we'll ever see the debt level fall. I mean, the notion that we're going to cut our debt level, I just don't think that's realistic. You know, the notion that the stock of debt will fall, that only fell once in the modern age or the modern era. And that was briefly during the Clinton administration when we ran a series of budget surpluses, right? And remember, that was a perfect storm. It was the end of the Cold War. So we had what was known then as the peace dividend. We also saw this massive revenue growth because that was when, if you recall, we were in the midst of the earlier tech telecom boom that generated lots of revenues. Growth in the U.S. was strong. So that was a really unique set of circumstances. I'll call it a perfect storm. So I don't think we're likely to see that perfect storm replicated going forward. The world is still a harsh place, in fact, becoming harsher. So we probably won't see a big peace dividend on that. And I think growth will be harder to come by. So to me, I think what we have to focus on is less trying to reduce the debt and more trying to stabilize the debt to GDP ratio. Now, that also can be tricky because, you know, you need to see that the growth rate in the level of debt is lower than the nominal economy is growing. In other words, when I look at real GDP growth and inflation, is that growing at a faster pace than we're accumulating debts? Because if I can see the economy outgrowing our debt, then that's actually a good thing. You can actually see the debt to GDP ratio stabilize and start to come down. It requires two things: progress in the numerator and progress in the denominator. Progress in the numerator means I have to have a solid, sustainable growth rate where we're talking about real growth and inflation at, let's say, something approaching 5.5-6% when all is taken into consideration, say 2-2.5% real GDP and say, you know, 2-3% or so inflation, right? That gets you to about 5.5-6% in terms of nominal GDP. But I also have to focus on the denominator. Right now, we're running deficits in excess of 6% per year. So I need to see that the level of federal spending begins to ease, that we start to address entitlements, and or we find additional sources of revenue. Again, not easy to do, but we don't have to see the debt go down. We just need to see that relationship stabilize and begin to reverse in order for our fiscal affairs to have a better outlook going forward.
I don't want to ask you a lot of questions about where the market's going. There's just too many things in play that you have no way of knowing how the tax bill and how Powell and all these things are going to work. But we'll take a stab at tariffs next. If you'd let me assume that the deals get done at some point with these countries, and let's just say that there's a, for argument's sake, a 10% tariff across the board, very simple. What's that look like for corporate earnings, the dollar, the economy? What does that look like? And if you don't agree that's the direction, please tell me what you think.
So let me broaden out a little bit, because I think you talked about the 10% tariffs, which is one component of the tariffs themselves. I think even if tomorrow, if the administration said, you know what, never mind, forget about it, we weren't really serious about the tariffs, we're going to roll them all back, we've seen enough commitments by our trading partners that, forget the whole exercise, we're going to go back to the roughly 2.5% tariffs that existed before President Trump took the oath of office. Even under that circumstance, I think there's already economic consequence. Look, you've disrupted global trade flows. You've certainly had an impact on business and consumer confidence. And also you called into question the reliability or the U.S.'s willingness to stand behind prior commitments, right? And this view that President Trump sees himself as a disruptor, right? And therefore, I think there's already economic consequence. I think it's limited. And I think, therefore, the economy would not fall into recession, but I think growth would be slower than it otherwise would have been. Now, we have to assume the administration is not going to say, forget about it. We're going to go back to 2.5% tariffs. We have to assume some of those tariffs will remain intact. I think your point about the 10% tariffs, I think that's pretty much baked in. Why do I think that's baked in? I think it's baked in for one simple reason. The administration needs revenues to offset the tax cuts. And one of the things that they've modeled into their budget assumptions with the budget bill that was just passed in the House last night, or this morning rather, and will now go to Senate for reconciliation, part of that includes some assumptions around what we're likely to see in terms of revenue generated by the tariffs. So that 10%, I would assume, is going to remain intact. Now, the other tariffs that you talked about, which we call the reciprocal tariffs, those are the ones that have to be negotiated country by country, right? And when they first came out, I would argue those tariffs were, I think there's efficacy, certain efficacy to what the administration is trying to do. They're trying to do two things. They're trying to correct for these trade imbalances, which I think it can be a good in principle. And then secondly, they want to draw more capacity back to the United States, especially in very sensitive or strategically important goods, because we recognized during COVID that this supply chain disruption, we're suddenly vulnerable. Our economy could come to a halt because we don't produce a lot of the things that our consumers and our economy requires, right? So I do think there's some efficacy behind this trying to correct these trade imbalances. I think the manner in which it's been done, though, is pretty arbitrary and heavy-handed. You know, simply taking the trade imbalance and dividing it by the number of imports and taking half of that and say, this is a reciprocal tariff. It gives no attention at all to how the tariffs emerge, why the imbalances exist, right? So to me, I think that was a very heavy-handed approach. Now, it means then that all of these reciprocal tariffs have to be negotiated one by one. You can't just do it across the board. Like the 10% tariffs were across the board. These are country by country, and therefore, this is going to take some time. Now, that 90-day window from the time of April 2nd, that runs through about July 8th. So that means then that we have in that window, we have to see the negotiations bear some fruit, or else we're going to revert back to the original tariffs. So I do think that those tariffs, both the 10% tariffs and the other tariffs, will have economic consequence. I think they will contribute to slower growth. I think in the short term, they'll probably push prices up. I don't know that they'll be inflationary longer term, but I do think what it also does here is it complicates the Fed's decision-making process. Why? Because it injects another element of uncertainty. The Fed has to kind of wait a little bit to see, okay, what's the economic fallout and how big an impact will it have on prices? Because I would argue otherwise, at this point, the Fed likely would have resumed and started resumption of their easing cycle and started cutting rates again, you know, this quarter. And now we probably will have to wait until at least the next quarter, you know, Q3, before the Fed resumes cutting rates again. So for those reasons, I do see the economy slowing as it related to the tariffs.
How about the global economy? Just a comment on that. Is it going to be affected pretty bad by these things or non-effect? How's that going to work?
Yeah, I hate to sound like an opinion of the economist here, but it depends. It depends on the country and it depends on the tariffs. I think some countries will be more heavily impacted than others. I think the two countries that I think could be most severely impacted are Mexico and China. Why? Because they have a large portion of their economy is exports, and they're two of our largest export partners. And remember, their economies are much, much smaller than the U.S. So not only are they two of the largest trading partners, but as a percent of their trade, it's very, very high. So if these sanctions remain in place and aren't negotiated down, I think the economic consequence for Mexico and Canada could be severe. I think as you back away from that, I think the next two biggest partners likely to be affected by that, not surprisingly, are China and the EU. Now, China, again, is a much more larger economy. And as a percent of their GDP, their exports to the U.S. is smaller than either Mexico or Canada are, but it's still consequential. China still counts heavily on exports to fund their domestic growth. It's important for them to have that market to maintain employment. So to the extent that there are punitive tariffs on China, that will certainly have an impact on Chinese growth. Not as severe as, say, Mexico and Canada, but certainly consequential. Now, China is already trying to push back against that by stimulating policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy, but there'll still be economic fallout. The EU hasn't quite felt the bite yet, but I think they could be also heavily impacted by this, because I think the U.S. is going to look at this not just in terms of the tariff issues, but also broader trade-related issues, right? So that negotiation may be even harder, because we do know that the EU has multiple layers of regulation. And this is not just about the tariffs. This is creating a more even playing field for U.S. companies to operate. So the regulatory environment matters as well. So I think the EU can get hit as well on this. So I'd say those are the four areas. Other countries obviously have huge footprints, or I shouldn't say not huge footprints, but they have lots of their exports come to the United States, but they tend to be smaller economies. But those four are the ones that I think would be most profoundly impacted. And again, the longer this goes on without resolutions, the higher the tariffs ultimately are settling in at, the greater the economic impact. The quicker we resolve the tariffs and the lower the tariff rates ultimately are, the less the impact there is.
Mike, the next part of this line of questionings I have is the obvious. All of our clients are wealthy, and it's our job to mitigate the risk and keep it that way. And that's why they're talking about bonds. Now, how about the municipal bond area? Used to be real easy for us. If you remember, we'd buy a AAA, an insured tax-free bond, put it on the books, and never even think about it. Now, thank God that the UBS has some great people in research and muni departments, because it's almost impossible to sort through that stuff. How do you see, and this will tie into the Fed chairman and all, I think, how do you see our municipal bond investments? Are these states safe out there? Are they safer than corporate bond? Maybe just make comments along that line. Are they timely?
I want to be careful about making generalized comments, because I think obviously, you know, there's probably no more, you know, heterogeneous market than the municipal market, because you have many local municipalities, cities, counties, states that issue, right? So it's 50 states, but all those 50 states have municipal governments, you know, local governments, county governments, city governments that issue their own debt, right? So to make a blanket statement about all municipals, I think is, I have to be careful about that. What I will say is the following. In general, you know, municipal credit quality is actually in fairly good shape. Municipalities have emerged from COVID, partly because massive federal support, but they didn't emerge with big imbalances or big debt burden. Revenues quickly caught up and recovered. So I would say most states are in good shape. Now, I think there are certain states, of course, where they have a couple of problems, where they have high levels of indebtedness. They made a lot of commitments to, you know, let's say, you know, public sector workers, pension plans, et cetera, where they're committed to that. And they're facing out migration of population as people relocate to other areas and retire to other areas of the country, either for a change of lifestyle or because of higher tax burdens, right? So I think there are certain states that are going to catch, you know, they're going to be under some pressure. Now, the question for those states is, can they find new sources of growth? Can they find new industries or attract talent that can offset those losses? Again, that's a question to be answered. So I do think we have to be careful state by state, you know, municipality by municipality. And that goes back to the comment you made before, John, about, you know, fortunately, we have really good guidance and advice. This is why I tell people, don't just go out and just buy an individual bond and stick it in your portfolio. You do want to make sure that someone's overseeing that, you know, like you and your team as advisors, that's what you do. That's your role. But I know you also rely on managers who have expertise in these markets, who that's what they do. And this is why I always think things like separately managed accounts are really good for managing municipal portfolios. Why? because you ultimately own the underlying bond, because you want that ability to own the asset itself. And it's professionally managed so that you know it's being watched after and people are making sure that they're staying up to date on developments within the market, right? So to me, I think, you know, that's why I like that style. Now, in terms of what I think about munis right now, I think munis have come under pressure like all fixed income has. You know, rates have backed up here. You know, we talked a little bit about the concerns over the budget and the deficits. Well, that has an impact on rates. And I think while it's certainly a federal debt problem, we do know that when treasury yields rise, yields tend to rise across the board. That includes all securities, including municipals. So to me, I think what you've seen is a little bit of volatility in the muni market as well. But I do think right now what you're seeing is that yields that are currently available in the muni market were yields we haven't seen for quite some time. And I would say for people looking to lock in some funding, lock in some coupon payments or tax-free interest payments, you know, you're seeing levels right now that we haven't had the ability to invest in quite some time. I would be opportunistic about that. Again, making sure that it's professionally managed, high credit quality. But I think this is an opportunity or a window here to add some fixed income to your portfolio, including municipals.
My next question is going to go down the line of AI. Now, I'm looking forward to this answer. You've been around as an adult since the 70s. You've been in leadership and in research and since the early 80s. You've seen all kind of new trends coming. Talk about this AI. And then eventually, if you think we're going to be able to make money on this, how do we do it? You know, how do we make money, not just are amazed by it? So can you go down that line for me?
Over the course of my life, I've seen many new technologies emerge and technology eras. When I was very young, it was the industrial age. You know, it was the technology revolution, the information age, the industrial revolution, the third industrial revolution. And we've seen things like the internet emerge. We've seen just a whole host of new technologies that have come through over the course of my 41 years in the industry. I would tell you there's no technology revolution like this one. This is profoundly transformational. People try and draw parallels between the tech telecom boom or the internet. This is profoundly different. This is a transformative technology. If you want to draw historical parallels, I think you have to go much further back in history. I think you have to go back to the Gutenberg printing press to find something that will have this profoundly transformational impact on how we live our lives, how we interact with one another, how businesses operate, opportunities that are created. Generative AI and machine learning are incredibly powerful. Now, in terms of how do we benefit from that? Well, look, I think this is going to be a very different type of technology. Every technology has had benefits, but there's always been limitations to them. That is where they could be introduced and scaled. What you're seeing with generative AI and machine learning is that it cuts across almost every industry. It cuts across most human activity. So to me, when we talk about, well, where will the opportunities emerge from? They'll emerge from almost everywhere. Now, right now, I think the focus is on what I call the infrastructure plays. It's those who've been building out the chips, the servers, the data centers that will be the backbone for powering this AI revolution. But what I think the next big phase is what I call the application phase. It's the users. It's the beneficiaries of this technology. It's the companies that will deploy this technology to improve productivity or to enhance creativity. That is, they'll cut costs by using this to displace labor, create more efficiencies, but they'll also create new products and services that will create entirely new revenue streams. So when I think about that, John, there's almost no industry that won't benefit from this. Now, they won't all benefit from equally. Some will be more profoundly impacted. Not all companies will be able to integrate this properly. Some will mismanage it. We know that. Now, fortunately, there is some work that's been done here through our CIO team. Rike Hoffman, who is our new CIO in the Americas here, she and her team put out several reports that called Transformational Investment Opportunities Trios. And they focused on two things. One is just the powerful application of AI and machine learning. So there's a whole host of work they've done, and they've identified companies who will be the beneficiary of that. But secondly, they also recognize that in order to power that transformation, it's going to require energy, right? One of the things we do know about generative AI and machine learning is it has a voracious appetite for data and a voracious appetite for energy, right? We have to fill those sources. So these trios don't just focus on the application of technology, but also on the enablement of energy production to make sure that revolution remains intact. So I'd strongly recommend taking a look at some of the work that's been done here in those transformational investment opportunities as a great source for how you want to think about the ideas for how to invest.
Your personal opinion, Mike, is there any industry you think might be a surprise? We talked to the tech analyst and he thought education would be the hidden surprise where AI has the most effect. But for us, our job is to make our clients money. Is there any particular, in the application side, you know, I think UBS has done a great job on the energy and the transformation and development of the AI, but the next phase, the application, anything you see personally that you think might surprise us?
Well, I see those two. And by the way, the surprise can work out either way. I think the biggest potential benefits here could actually come in healthcare. Because, you know, we're not just talking then about generative AI and machine learning. We're also talking about other technologies like synthetic biology, right? Which is, to me, is another similarly transformational technology that's recurrent and partly dependent on generative AI and machine learning, right? We're seeing, you know, a whole host of therapeutics being created around using AI and machine learning, right? So I see the healthcare industry could be profoundly impacted by this and huge benefits. Here's the problem, though, is a lot of this requires data and information. And some of that data and information becomes difficult to access because of HIPAA laws, right? So to me, I think one of the drawbacks is going to be, well, how do you access the information, the raw data that's necessary to begin the process of transforming a sector? So there's pluses and minuses there. But that certainly would be one where I think if we were able to fully find a way of deploying this technology, I think the opportunities to exploit are almost limitless. And it could yield incredible benefits in terms of, you know, living standards for global population. I think the other area, which you don't hear talk about as much, and I think it's not necessarily an investment case, but it's certainly a productivity case, is government. Look, we have lots of things that our government does right now. Any of you who've been, you know, forced to go to, you know, Social Security to get your claims processed or trying to get benefits as a veteran, you know, it's not the easiest process to go through. That is ripe for innovation, for innovative solutions, especially since AI now is not only doing things much more efficiently, but you're able to build a certain empathetic element into generative AI and machine learning as well. So that's an area ripe for innovation. Whether that's an area for opportunity for investments is different, because I think that's one where you're just trying to create efficiencies, which, by the way, could yield us benefits in terms of how we deal with things like our fiscal affairs down the road. But again, this will take time. And remember, governments tend to embrace change very slowly. So I'd be surprised if government were the principal beneficiary there. But you asked me for surprises, and that would certainly be one.
You mentioned electric. What are your thoughts? You know, there's nuclear. Can it happen? Tell me how you think they're going to develop this next 10 years or so. And is there any way for us to make money in that?
Well, I think it's going to have to happen. I think, look, you know, we're facing an energy transition right now. There's a view globally, and I think it's large of you here in the U.S., that simply being eternally dependent upon fossil fuels is not a good long-term strategy. Eventually, fossil fuels will either wear out or they'll wear the planet out, depending upon how you view this. To me, and we have to recognize, of course, that energy transformation has been a constant. People forget the energy crisis of the 1800s was we were running out of whales. There weren't enough whales around. The whale oil was such an important source of energy back in the 1700s and 1800s. So we always transition our forms of energy. That's a constant, right? And the question is, what's the next transformation likely to yield? Now, to me, I'll go back to the fact that you mentioned nuclear. I think nuclear is going to be important. If we look at the incremental demand from AI and machine learning, not to mention the incremental demand that's coming from cryptocurrencies and the mining of these crypto assets, that is quickly outpacing our ability to produce energy. Now, either we decide we're going to reopen coal power plants, or we're going to continue to build out our gas plants, which certainly could happen. But there's still going to be a void created there. And until we get some other technology like blue hydrogen, that's many decades in the future, arguably, I need to have a placeholder there. And certainly, I think that's going to require nuclear. Now, the problem with nuclear, though, is even if you start today, it's going to take about 10 years, 8 to 10 years before you get a plant operational. There's a lot of safety protocols, appropriately so. But I do think what you're starting to see is innovation in the industry in terms of smaller modular plants, plants that can now be located coincident to certain types of industrial capacity, for example, right near a data center, you can put it near a data center, or put the data center in a nuclear plant. So I do think that's going to be part of the solution. I do think that's going to be part of the energy mix. And there are some companies, again, I'll go back to the energy transformation I mentioned before that's being worked on by the CIO office. They focus on some of the alternatives there as well.
Now, I could go on all morning, but I'm getting a hook here. We're running close to the end of our time. And any final thoughts that you want to share with us that we might not cover, do you think it's real important to talk about?
Look, I think we have to recognize we've entered into a period of heightened volatility. For the last couple of years, we've had things pretty good. Markets generally trended higher, especially if you were narrowly concentrated in some tech stocks, you did extraordinarily well. But even if you're in the broad indices, you were generating 20% plus returns. We had fairly docile interest rate environments. So the last 2 years have been a pretty good environment. I think this year and next year are going to be very different. It's going to be more volatility. I think such narrowly concentrated positions in a market will not be beneficial going forward. I need more broadly diversified portfolios. I need a better mix of assets. I can't just be focused on tech stocks. I got to be focused on who will be the next benefit of the monetization of AI and machine learning. I need to have not just equity, but also fixed income in my portfolio as a buffer and a source of income. So I do think taking a broadening out our investment approach and moving away from this very narrowly concentrated seven stock obsession is going to be one of the most critically important things that we do over the course of the next 2 years.
Well, thank you, Mike. We appreciate your time with us. And if anyone listening would like one of Mike's reports from the Transformational Opportunity Trios report, feel free to reach out to our team or James. We'll send that out to you. They are very good reports. Our team does an excellent job of covering those themes. This call will also be recorded as a podcast. You can go to the Pateko Wealth Management Podcast site on Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe and listen to the previous speaker series calls that we've had. And I want to say thank you again, Mike, for joining us.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.